With me to discuss our latest thinking on the coronavirus and its impact on economies and markets is our co-CIO, Greg Jensen, and our Chief Security Officer, Richard Falkenrath. Richard, you're here because you have long experience in dealing with things like the coronavirus. I'd like you to just take a moment to tell us about that experience.
Well, Jim, my background is in national security, and I was working in the White House before 9/11, during 9/11, and then after 9/11. And after 9/11, we had a lot of other kinds of disasters, and one of them was the SARS outbreak. And so I was centrally involved in the U.S. government's response to SARS, and I acquired some familiarity with the issues that a country would face when dealing with a newly emerged infectious disease.
Now, you wrote about this in the February 3rd Daily Observations, but I just want to ask you, there's flu every year, you know, throughout the world, and it kills many people. And yet, infectious diseases like coronavirus or SARS or MERS, why are those ones more dangerous and differentiated?
Well, flu is influenza. It's a virus that's been pandemic in human beings for a very long time. And there are lots of diseases that are in all humans. They're called pandemics, all humans, comes from the Latin. And we exist in equilibrium with these diseases. We get used to them, we adapt our societies to them, we have an immunological response to them that makes them manageable, and they just flow around among human populations all over the world. What's happening now is something that's happened throughout time, which is a new virus jumps into the human species from another species. And during that period, there's an adaptation that has to occur with both the virus and the host. And it will take a while for the adaptation to result in a new equilibrium. And that's the phase that we're in right now. We, as in human beings, have been in this situation many, many times before. And in most cases, it becomes invisible, just disappears into the background. Every once in a while, one comes along that's really disruptive. And that's what this one seems to be.
When we talk about infectious diseases, you outlined a framework, you know, a sort of a three-part framework. And the first component of that framework was a medical analysis. Explain to us a little bit about what that is all about.
So the three parts I suggested was medical, psychological, and infrastructure and policy response. And on the medical side, let me first say, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist, but I have learned who to ask and what sorts of questions to ask about these things. We, of course, start with the government agencies. So we start with the WHO, CDC, other national public health services, and we consume every single day all the information that they're putting out. But then in addition to that, we've got a list of essentially really believable virologists, immunologists, epidemiologists, who we are in constant contact with, some of whom we have on contract. And what I think it's really important to do as we interpret all the data that's coming at us, and there's a huge amount of data, is to understand what is good data and what is the source of that data, but also what is unknown and what is the implication of that unknown. Experts will be studying this outbreak for decades to come and trying to answer basic questions that we're asking right now today. They're very hard to come up with all the answers. I just want to make it very clear, there are lots of things we don't know.
So let's go and unpack a little bit about what we do know.
So what we do know is very infectious, and we do know the case fatality rate is non-trivial. The best data that we've got about the actual cases actually came from the Chinese government. They've disclosed about 80,000 cases. The case fatality rate among those 80,000 cases is about 2.3%, according to that data. Now, it's correlated with age and respiratory comorbidity, which is a flu-like consequence. And that's actually a good news thing for the world, but it's pretty high on that. The thing that the Chinese have not disclosed, because they literally can't due to testing strategies, are all the non-severe cases that exist outside of that population. And that's something that really has the global public health community worried, because they know that non-severe cases can also result in spread, possibly exponential spread. And so there's a belief among many, there's no data behind this, that the actual number of cases is significantly higher. The challenge on the data is the data they don't have. And you can't get data on cases unless you're testing for it. And if you test for it, as we've learned in Iran and Italy and South Korea, you tend to find it. This has led some experts, and as I say, I'm interpreting data that others are generating, we're not independently generating, to conclude this will become a pandemic and is not a containable virus. And yesterday, the CDC, in fact, basically said that.
Okay, so now the psychological effect, when you are in this realm of a potential global pandemic, the psychological effects, explain that.
Yeah, this really became clear to me at the White House in 2003 when we were dealing with SARS, that the massive human psychological reaction to an event like this can overwhelm for a period of time the medical course of the disease itself and can create huge pressure on policymakers and leaders and family units to do something, even if the net effect of doing something is not net good on that. But it's just a reality. It is a reality that the level of anxiety that's coursing through the world right now as a result of something like this is extremely high and will likely keep growing for a while until it starts tapering off and people acclimate to the new situation. And that has to be dealt with in a real way. Just because medically something may not make sense or be validated on a data level, psychologically it's very real in every person wrestling with this and in various organizations of people. And just take that really seriously and understand that's part of the phenomenon that we're going to go through.
And then the third thing you list out is infrastructure. What do you mean by that?
There are really two parts of it. The policy response to diseases like this will involve social distancing, isolation, public health measures, canceling of events, canceling schools. And that's done from a sound public health reason, which is social distancing will slow a spread for a period of time. It can also go too far, but there's a good public health reason for that. But in addition to policy responses, there's decisions being made everywhere in the economy and society about what events to hold, where to go, what flights to take, what air crews go to what airplanes, what unions permit their people to go back to work. And those are decentralized and somewhat spontaneous and unplanned, and their cumulative effect is hard to predict. And they will sometimes build on themselves. And so unpacking that is very, very difficult. It's not a permanent condition. Things eventually adapt, but there are going to be lots of spontaneous actions in society and in the economy that will play out as a result of the other two layers that we talked about.
And so as you assess the developments on where we are today, all of these things are still in an up phase, or do you see any evidence whatsoever that they've moderated or would go in a down phase?
So the bookends of worst and best case are the H1N1 epidemic of 2009 as a best case, and the Spanish flu of 1918 as a worst case. H1N1 in 2009, we got really worried about. It jumped species. We think it came from birds, probably. It happens to be the same viral type as the Spanish flu in 1918, and it rapidly spread through the whole world and was a complete non-event. We know this one is more lethal than H1N1 in 2009, but that's really what can happen. It can just disappear. People can get really worried, and then it just vanishes.
Let's go back and just ask about the analogy to the SARS breakout, which you were so familiar with when you were in the White House, which is when you look at the virus today, you know, COVID-19, is that, in your view, a different situation than SARS, more severe?
SARS did not become a pandemic. SARS burned itself out. And most of the transmission that occurred with SARS that got it to the number of cases that it got happened in hospital settings. SARS had a quite high case fatality rate. And a high fatality rate for a disease like this actually is something that contributes to it burning out quickly. That often happens. A virus that's too lethal kills the host and then it kills itself. The other side is 1918. And 1918 is the one that scares everybody the most. One of the largest demographic shocks in human history happened. And it was a new strain of flu that first appeared actually in Kansas, of all places, in February of 1918, and was a fairly bad case of flu, but then died out. Then it reappeared in Flanders and in the trenches in Europe in June and July, and was pretty bad. But then it also tamped down. But then it came back with a vengeance in October and November of 1918, the third wave, which was the biggest demographic shock that we've ever recorded. We don't know how many people died, but it's in the tens of millions totally, and it affected maybe upward of 500 million people. And that's the case that really has everyone absolutely terrified. Interestingly, it quickly died out as well. And while it was a huge shock at the time with enormous social disruption and some historical impacts, it by 1919, 1920, it was gone.
And so when you sum that up and you look at the evidence of where we are right now, what is your confidence and where would you put us in terms of that realm of best case versus worst case?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty about which way this will go. Will it continue to accelerate up? Will it tamp down? I mean, I really don't want to over-index on the things that look really scary with all the upward growth. So I think the uncertainty goes both directions. And but nonetheless, there are lots of concerning things. And I think we have an adaptation process to this new condition that will take a while and be disruptive.
Greg, we heard from Richard on how we're assessing the coronavirus from an investment point of view. And if you look at the global economic impact, what is the latest in what we're seeing?
I think what we know is that there's a very significant short-term impact on the economy. And the big question is, how will this play out? Right? We've set up our processes for measuring growth and managing money through thinking through many historical events. Right? When we think about pandemic, we've thought about this back during SARS and at other periods, recognizing these come along and that there's once-in-a-lifetime events of different natures, and pandemics are one of those types of things that can be very extreme and have large disruptive impacts. So we've thought about those things. Now, when you look at the shape of them, if you take the history of those impacts, they tend to have short-term large impacts on the economy. But when you look at it over a longer time frame, a lot of that is made up because there's a response from policymakers and there is a catch-up in those economies if it doesn't spiral. So when you think about the impact on the economy, whatever the shock is, the main question, the difference between a shock that happens and passes and a shock that stays with us in terms of an economic impact is really a function of whether it flows into the credit system, which is what we're really going to be monitoring. And if it doesn't have the second order impact of creating credit problems, then it will probably pass, as Richard said, eventually one way or the other will adjust to the new circumstances, and that impact will be muted in that way. But there is a risk that it does flow through the credit system. And when you weigh this, the two sides of that risk, there's the one side, which is never in the history of the world have central banks been more plugged in to provide liquidity where it's needed than they have. The problems of the financial crisis created this ecosystem where liquidity could be pumped to many, many corners of the earth fairly effectively. And at the same time, there's high levels of debt and the impact of monetary policy, because interest rates are low and there's already a lot of liquidity, is limited mm-hmm. to offset a major shock. So you've got to weigh both sides of those, and we're trying to weigh them. Now, directly to your question, well, what's the impact been so far? We go country by country, measuring the different flow-throughs that we expect, the direct flow-through from demand, the more indirect flow-throughs as supply channels are being disrupted, and adding that up to say, well, what do we think the impact on the stats are going to be? How weak is growth going to come out? And you're going to see a major shock to GDP in the first quarter in the world for sure. What will that mean for the whole year? That it depends how this path plays out, how people end up reacting, how quickly things can come back together. And that is what we're measuring.
And to be clear, right now, while you're seeing the temporary impacts, you are not seeing a cascading in any of the credit systems around the world.
That's right. It's early, but that's right. We're not seeing a cascading credit event. So if you take right now what we think the impacts are based on what's known, and this is very loose, right, that you've got a range of the impact on based on what's known here is something from like Hong Kong having for the whole year probably a decrease in GDP of minus 3.4. That could obviously get worse or better. Now, much more in the first quarter. But that's kind of what, when you weigh those different kinds of effects on the economy, to something in the U.S. much more modest. So minus 0.2% based on the things that have occurred so far. You'll have some export things and you'll see the stats of the first quarter weak and the impact of first quarter GDP will be multiples of that. But across the year, that's what you would be saying, and we'll see how that transpires and how the cumulative new things add up to affect those.
Let's talk about Europe for a second, because clearly now a number of countries in Europe are reporting cases, and Europe has the least fuel in the tank and is sort of weak relative to the rest of the world. How worried are you about what impact this could have on Europe, and do you worry about systemic risk?
Yeah, well, there's certainly a lot to worry about, because like you said, probably the biggest problem with the current underlying environment economically is the fact that you've got these relatively weak economies with central banks that are already stretched, and not in Europe in particular, not an easy way to address problems through fiscal policy. And so you've got those challenges. On the other hand, the ECB is dedicated to creating the liquidity and whatever it takes and is set up to provide the liquidity necessary to those areas. You've already seen Germany relax the fiscal rules to allow for emergency reactions to these across Europe. So I do think that you'll see a policy response. It is it will not have the size that it might need, and that could become a problem. And beyond this, of course, there's the how this situation contributes to the social conflict that we already see as a major theme in this environment as well. You've got major social conflict issues that are raising the risks of more significant policy changes across the developed world. And those things are big, and you could imagine a situation like this accelerating that. You're seeing that to some degree in more political infighting in Italy already over whether this is being handled acceptably or poorly. And so you're going to potentially see an upsurge in the conflict. So if you take the things that we see in the underlying environment, the inability of central banks to have a large impact on economic growth, the increase in political conflict, certainly these add to those things. And on the other side of that is the fiscal response and the fact that market pricing is already pricing some of this in.
And if you look also at the European economy, it does have a lot of export reliance, particularly Germany, right, and a lot of export reliance into Asia. So let's talk about Asia for a second, because China is just a much larger component of the global economy and within Asia than it was when Richard was talking about the SARS outbreak, you know, almost 20 years ago. So the outlook for Asia right now, is that uncertain, but we can expect relatively large declines in those economies? How are you looking at that?
I mean, there already has been, right, this very significant hit. So if you're watching China in particular, is obviously the largest part of it, went through almost a freeze and a several-week freeze in the, you know, the most significant economy from a growth perspective in the world, is a big deal. And like you said, that's going to ripple through Europe. That's going to ripple through a lot of countries. And, you're only going to begin to start seeing the ripple of that. On the other hand, we're measuring very closely what's happening in China. And you're starting to see from a very low base in a very gradual way, we'd say that the economy in China hit a bottom about a week and a half ago and has been improving a little bit since, very slowly, well off the appropriate levels. And the main question is, will that continue in the sense that will the disease pop up again as people go back to work? Because that's starting to happen. People are gradually going back to work. Or have they successfully contained it that actually you can continue to get a return to normalcy in China? Because that's been a big deal, is you're starting to see that. Now, you're only in the beginning phase. If you take Korea, it's where China was in terms of the rate of growth of the diseases, you know, several weeks ago. You're only in the beginning of the impact on Korea, another critical economy, critical to supply chains. And so we'll be monitoring carefully whether you continue to get that improvement in China. Do the arcs in the other countries play out like the arc in China, where you get this acceleration and then a deceleration and a return? Or does it have another wave in China? How do those arcs play out? Because those will all be very big to how long the disruption is and what the nature of the improvement is. If you take the SARS epidemic, there's a reasonable, much smaller than today, but reasonable impact on quarterly growth. But then because there was a bounce and a recovery, if you looked at annual growth rates across Asia in the SARS epidemic, the down was made up for in the subsequent quarter, and you can't even see it in the charts. And so that's way too optimistic given the circumstances that it would be just like that. But on the other hand, that is part of what the path will likely be like, maybe not in the degree of the shape, but it'll be like that, both because they'll be made up, there'll be a makeup period, and there will be policy responses.
Okay, let's turn to market action. So if you look at market action, this week was, you know, a material shift from where we've been, which is equity markets have sold off pretty hard. I mean, in the big scheme of things, not a big, big move, but definitely relative to the recent past. Bond markets have rallied significantly, nominal bond markets. Does all that market pricing make sense to you in terms of what we're seeing about the spread of the virus in terms of the news?
It's interesting to think about what are the markets saying. And one of the reasons why we think you have to be very careful how you react to the news, because the market's simultaneously reacting to the news. And they might be overreacting, they might be underreacting, right? If we look at the general pattern of major events, they tend to be under-discounted in the beginning as the news is accumulating and over-discounting at the end. Of course, that's easier to see in retrospect when you don't know where the end is and the beginning is. It's tougher to say in real time. But when we look at, well, what is happening in the markets, and one of the things we've developed over the years is how to read the markets. And I look at the current events, and you know, we put this out in recent daily observations, the impact on profits that's being discounted by this. Now, it's a little hard to say how much of the stock move and the interest rate move should you call a decline in expected profits? cash flows, and how much should you consider risk premium? Because both things are happening simultaneously. Clearly, there's a, now this new volatile thing that'll affect growth and maybe different potential durations. But when we roughly look at that, we think the markets are pricing in for the whole year across many major economies, something like a 20% decline in earnings as a result of this. And if you didn't put half of the impact on risk premiums, that would be a 40% decline in earnings. Mm-hmm. That's a really big impact from this. It would be more a larger impact than we think when we've studied the past pandemics and across all the way back to the Spanish flu. Of course, it might turn out to be true. This situation could get a lot worse than it currently is, but it would require that. So as you're thinking about, do I react, do I not react, recognizing how much of a how much has been priced in, that a big economic impact, an ongoing economic impact, and a really big hit to aggregate profits is what's already been discounted in the markets. What you're also seeing in the movement in gold and whatever is this, what is safe in a world in bigger risk, right? And you're seeing that as the question of what the policy responses will be and what how social conflict will be dealt with. All of that's leading to this shift into treasury bonds.
What's interesting is that in China, we've had a big sell-off in stocks, but a big rally in bonds. It seems to be working as you would expect it to work.
Yeah, I would say it's another stress test of the Chinese markets. And from our perspective, they're working, as you've seen in past cases in other countries, makes sense to us in terms of a reasonable thing in a balanced portfolio in China, has gone through this type of impact in a way that's consistent with our expectations. And you're seeing a recovery in the Chinese markets as the situation goes from less a China-focused disease to the global disease. And so you're seeing different market reactions. In the beginning, you saw certainly an Asia-based market reaction. Today, I mean, over the last few days, you've seen a very global reaction with, if anything, Chinese markets outperforming the rest of the world.
Well, a lot to absorb across multiple dimensions. Richard, Greg, thank you very much.